Again.
This meeting is being recorded.
So, we finished last Wednesday with Earthlin's wonderful talk. Our couple months of seminars on the hidden lamp. So, my talk today, I'm going to add one more talk to that series to complete the series this time around. I'm sure we'll study that again. And this case from the hidden lamp is about precepts. And I want to offer this talk in honor of the precepts group that has been meeting for some time now. I think it's just ended as we take our summer break. Led by John Murray, Jeff Bickner, Peter Vandersteer, and Kathy Fisher. And I've been hearing that it was a wonderful group, much appreciated by everyone, so I want to dedicate my talk to all the people who were in that group, leading it and participating in it. The name of the story is Upalavana and the Precepts. Here's the story. The nun Upalavana was a disciple of the Buddha. She visited the home of some noble young women and encouraged them to become nuns. And they said, "But we are young and beautiful and full of life, and it would be hard for us to keep the precepts." And Upalavana said, "If you break the precepts, you break the precepts. Just leave the household and become nuns." And the women said to her, "But if we break the precepts, we'll fall into hell. Why would you have us do that?" And Upalavana said, "Well, go ahead and fall into hell." And the women all laughed as, you know, what is an absurd thing for her to say, and they said, "Why would you say that?" And she said, "In a former life, I was a prostitute and an entertainer. And one day I dressed myself in nun's robes with the okesa and everything, and paraded around in front of my customers as a kind of joke. But because I did this, in my next life, I became a nun and took the precepts. But even though I was a nun, I was arrogant and broke the precepts. And as a consequence, I fell into hell and all of its sufferings. And later, in that same current life, I met Shakyamuni Buddha, ordained, developed great meditative powers and became an arhat." I'm sorry, it's in this current life, she said. In this current life, the life I'm in now, "I met Shakyamuni Buddha, ordained, developed great meditative powers, and became an arhat. In this way, I learned that you can attain the fruit of the way even if you break a precept and fall into hell. The merit of receiving the precepts makes awakening possible. But if you never receive the precepts and do unwholesome things, you will never attain the way." So that's the story. And I'm going to read you the entire comment as it appears in the Hidden Lamp. And this is a comment by the great and truly awesome and admirable nun, Thubten Chodron, who I have had the great privilege and honor of meeting once or twice. She is a senior teacher of Tibetan Buddhism, an American. And she really is one of the most important figures in Western Tibetan Buddhism. She's a direct student of the Dalai Lama, among other lamas. And she is the founder and the abbess of Srivasti Abbey, up in the Pacific Northwest, which is the only Tibetan Buddhist training monastery for Western nuns and monks in the United States. She is also a central figure in the long-standing effort to reinstate the bhikshuni ordination, the ordination of women, which disappeared from Buddhism, largely, except in Japan. She's been instrumental in reinstating that. It now exists again, thanks to her and others. Anyway, that's just a little about who she is. She writes, this is her commentary, as one of the great senior nuns at the time of the Buddha, Upalavana was specifically praised by the Buddha as being the nun foremost in the six super knowledges, psychic powers such as clairvoyance, that were possessed only by liberated beings. So she was a really strong, amazing practitioner. She was no ordinary practitioner, Thubten Chodron says, but someone whose life was dedicated to the Dharma and to benefiting others. Her first exchange with the young women in the koan reminds me of conversations I've had with women and men who have expressed interest in becoming monastics but recoil when I encourage them. And they say, but I can't possibly keep the precepts, it's too hard. Their negative self-image stops them from following the path to awakening. While it may sound strange for Upalavana to nonchalantly say, if you break the precepts, you break the precepts, as if it were not a big deal, in fact, she's encouraging these women to go beyond their perfectionistic tendencies and self-deprecation and give it a try. Stop getting in your own way by telling yourself you're incapable of doing something that you admire. Have some confidence that you can realize your beautiful Buddha potential. She knows that they are capable of attaining awakening, and to prove this, she recounts her own experience in a previous life as a prostitute. And in that life, as a joke, she puts on monastic robes, you know, she wears the okesa, the sacred okesa, and maybe she seductively lowered the robes to reveal her breasts or raised them to reveal her legs as if to say, what fools these nuns are. Who in their right mind would want to be celibate and give up sensual pleasure? But the symbol of the monastic robes touched something deeper in her, planting a seed so that in her future rebirth she could become a nun. Still, she was arrogant and defiant, broke the precepts, and fell into hell. But hell is not an external state, and it's not an eternal state. When that karma was exhausted, Upalavana was born once again as a human being. She underwent great suffering in her family that is not recounted in this story, and the whole time, despite her misery, much of which centered around sex, husbands, and children, the seed of liberation was being fertilized in her. At last, Upalavana became a monastic. Overcoming her fear and despondency, she practiced the path, and by taming her mind through keeping the precepts, she attained liberation. Had she never given this a try, she never would have become an awakened being. When I speak to those with monastic aspirations who hesitate, I remind them that we take precepts because we are not capable of keeping them perfectly. If we were capable of keeping them perfectly, we would not need to take them. If we never challenge ourselves, falling down in the process, we will not be able to transform our body, speech, and mind into those of a liberated being. Upalavana's story could equally apply to people who choose to remain householders and who keep the five lay precepts to abandon killing, stealing, unwise or unkind sexual behavior, lying, and intoxicants. However, Upalavana, like the Buddha himself, was a monastic. There is something precious about monastic life, which is hard to describe in this day and age when people think that choosing to be celibate is strange. Having been a monastic for 35 years, by now more than 40, I'm sure, I cherish the opportunity to hold precepts and live as a renunciant. Even though I have not kept my precepts perfectly, they support me on the path, subduing the mind and opening the heart. Like the young women in the koan, I initially lacked confidence in my ability to keep the precepts. I tried following the example of the Tibetan nuns, being quiet, shy, and self-effacing, but it didn't work. I was a university-educated woman with a career, schooled in expressing my ideas. On the other hand, I was arrogant and full of attachment and anger. My physical, verbal, and mental actions definitely needed to be subdued. What held me steady in the Dharma, despite the waves of my emotions and preconceptions, was the knowledge that my mind is the creator of my happiness and my suffering. There was nothing else to do but practice the Dharma to transform my mind. Fortunately, I had excellent spiritual mentors who guided me and whose instructions I had enough good sense to follow. I am eternally grateful to the Buddha for initiating the monastic Sangha and for the centuries of bhikshunis, female monastics, who have practiced diligently. Due to their kindness, the priceless option of becoming a monastic still exists today. And that is her commentary, Thubten Chodron's commentary. Dogen repeats this same story of Upalavana as a prostitute in one of his fascicles that has to do with the power of the robe, the almost mystical power of the okesa and the rakasu. And there he makes the point that the robe has a powerful effect on our karmic life stream, even if, like the prostitute, we defile it. Still, it has enormous influence on us. And in the fascicle, he's talking about the robe itself, the physical robe, but I'm sure he also means that the physical robe is what it is because it's imbued with its meaning, which is the path of the Buddha, the path of human goodness, the path that I think is at the heart of every human being, that we could transcend our ordinary suffering and selfishness and become a blessing for others. And this dream, this thought that I think lies in the heart of every person, is more powerful and more cosmic than we know. And that's one of the things the story of Upalavana is saying. And even though we are all, you know, 21st century people, ordinary, rational people with an ordinary, everyday sense of what our lives are, at the same time, our practice does cultivate in us a kind of cosmic or religious sense of life. We actually say in the Jukai and Tokudo ceremonies, we say, even after you become a Buddha, which might be like many lifetimes from now, will you still follow this path of mercy that I am passing on to you? And we all say, yes, I will. And when we say, yes, I will, we take that very seriously. And I am serious in the ceremony when I ask the ordinees, will you do this? I'm serious about it. So the precepts are rules of conduct. They define, however indistinctly, or profoundly a way of conduct, a way of life. But I think we also understand that the precepts are more awesome than we know. In her commentary, Thupten Chodron focuses on monasticism and monastic precepts, which figure into the story and into her life too. And her tradition is a little different from ours. She mentions the five precepts that lay people take, and as you know, in our tradition, we don't take five precepts, we take 16 precepts. And we understand these precepts not just, as I say, as rules of conduct, but also as describing the deepest possible path of practice beyond this lifetime and beyond this discriminatory mind. As a celibate nun whose lifestyle is radically different from the norm of contemporary secular life, I mean, it's more than being celibate. It means, you know, you don't live in a house, you don't wear regular clothes. It's a very radical lifestyle, very foreign to what most people in the world, all over the world, live today. But as such, of course, she's thinking of the monastic life. And the monastic life, even now, in a distinctly non-monastic historical period, the monastic life has always been, from the beginning, the lifeblood of Buddha Dharma. I'm sure that if Buddhist monasticism were to entirely disappear, so would Buddhism. If there weren't some people who gave up ordinary life altogether and were entirely devoted only to formal Dharma, I think the Dharma would lose its backbone. Despite teachings like the Vimalakirti Sutra that we read not so long ago that make fun of monastic discipline and the narrowness that can be characteristic of monastic life, we know that practically speaking, it just makes sense that the more focused and the more thorough and the narrower the effort is, the stronger is the Dharma power. So I'm really grateful that Thupten Chodron says this here. It reminds us. It's not what necessarily the emphasis of most of the other teachers in The Hidden Lamp. And I think we all ought to bow deeply to the monastics of the world, not only the Buddhist ones, but any monastic, and recognize how noble and how important is the commitment that they have made. Also, we ought to take their example as a challenge. Because, as she says, all of us need to surpass ourselves. All of us need to be able to do and be what we imagine we can never do and be. Because to really practice is to throw away, to go beyond the persons we have been conditioned to think we are, and really and truly become Buddhas. In the end, you know, that's what non-self means, right? We really cannot afford to be limited by our sense of who we think we are. We don't need higher self-esteem. We need self-esteem that's literally off the charts, beyond self-esteem. We need to be Buddhas. That's our practice. Just the same in our tradition as in hers. Okay, now I have another story about precepts. And this one is from the Shonan Kato Roku, which is the Japanese collection that I of koans, Japanese, not Chinese, collection of koans that I mentioned in my talk last month. And I never heard of this before, but I learned about it from Sue and Florence because they used it for some of the stories in their book. There happened to be a number of stories about women in this text. It's the source of the story that I talked about last month, and also Earthland talked about last week. The mirror practice of Tokeji Monastery is in this collection. So now here's another story from that collection, number 89. And as you'll see, the stories in this collection tend to be not short like in the stylized Chinese koan collections, but rather lengthy and discursive. Anyway, this story is called Sadatsune Receives the Precepts. In the fourth month of the 10th year of Oe, which is 1403 in our Julian way of counting the years starting from the birth of Christ. In the fourth month of the 10th year of Oe, the Ajari, the high priest, Shinsho of the Ritsu sect was the Vinaya sect, the precept sect, set up an ordination platform for a public ceremony, the classical Buddhist rite of administering the precepts. Doe Sadatsune went to this ceremony and asked the Ajari, are the precepts administered to the body or are they administered to the mind? Good question. Who would ever think, you know, of asking that? But yeah, it's a good question, right? Sadatsune said, if it's to the body to which they're administered, what happens when the four great elements become separated at death and the body disintegrates into parts, you know, molecules and stuff? Is that the end of the precepts? And if it's to the heart or the mind, same thing, then that's something which, when we try to find it, we can't get hold of it. So how could they be administered to something which is ungraspable and formless? So the Ajari answered him, unless one has faith that he or she is receiving them, they cannot be administered. And Sadatsune said, when we try to find the heart, we cannot get hold of it. So how could you say that the precepts are administered? Don't you know that it says in the Heart Sutra, there's no eye, nor ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, form, sound, smell, taste, touch, no object of mind? If that's true, how could there ever be precepts administered? And the Ajari couldn't answer. So Sadatsune went to Ganmyo, who was in charge of the Bell Pagoda at Kenchoji, and repeated this whole dialogue and put it to him. And Ganmyo said, the essence of the precepts which we teach in our school is that heart, Buddha, and living beings are all three without distinction between them. As all people are endowed with the essence, we don't speak of administering or receiving it. The application of the precepts is to perform the great Dharma while in the world and finally to practice it as a monk, and this is the human path. So he seems to be making a distinction here between the application of the precepts, a dynamic living of the precepts, and the administration of the precepts. Anyway, he goes on. The form of the precepts is perfect performance of the classical ceremony. If there is a person in whom the application of them appears clearly, that person is revered by the world. Thus the precepts pervade both absolute and provisional truth and become a way of opening up realization in place of ignorance. They are the Dharma which brings peace to the country and happiness to the people. But Sadatsune was still not satisfied. He didn't like that answer. He didn't think that went far enough. He said, I'm not speaking about the rights and wrongs of the precepts, but only the truth about administering and receiving the precepts. He still thinks, how can you take the precepts? It doesn't make sense. How is that possible? And so far, nobody has been able to satisfy him. So, Ganmyo brought this matter to Hogai, who was a Zen teacher. And Hogai invited Sadatsune to visit him. And Hogai said to him, why should we need many words about administering and receiving the precepts of Dharma? At which point he stared at him with a penetrating glance, you know, like Zen masters do, you know, screwing up one eye maybe and just looking at him. Which I guess impressed Sadatsune. And then he called out to him in a loud voice, Sadatsune! And Sadatsune immediately said, yes! And the teacher said, the precepts have been administered. And at this, Sadatsune finally was satisfied, and he said, ah! Today, the precepts have been completely received. So that's a long-winded story with lots of twists and turns. And what does it tell us? Well, I think maybe the precepts group, when it resumes in September, can take up this story and talk about it, because I think that there's a lot that we could discuss about this story. I don't know. What does it all mean? You know, what is he saying? What are the various dips in the road here? I can tell you, though, that over the last several decades, I have really been developing the thought that's been sort of more and more, seems more and more true to me as time goes on, that the precepts are the main thing that the Buddha taught and valued. They're not a side road. They're the main road. And they say, you know, some scholars claim now that at the end of his life, Dogen was in the process of revising the entire Shobogenzo to reflect the fact that he also felt that the precepts were the most important thing. In other words, despite the way that Buddhism came to us in the West, and still the way I think a lot of people look at it, in fact, the Buddha Dharma is not about meditation. It's not about insight. It's not about enlightenment. It's about how we live in this actual world that we have been given, and how we live in worlds beyond this world as life and death dynamically flows on and on. It's certainly true. We appreciate what the Heart Sutra says. No eyes, no ears, no body, no mind, no you, no me. Really. And yet, moment after moment, we reappear and are called out by life and death. And this seems to be the point of our practice. It's not about how much we know or how serene our meditation is or how nice we are to people or how good we are. It's how we respond fully to every moment of our lives. So we have a powerful sense that this life isn't just for this life, and that precepts as rules and guidance for ethical conduct are only part of why we value and have faith in them. Precepts are dynamic life, Zenki, as Dogen writes, total dynamic working. And of course we practice doing right and avoiding wrong. But our life of precepts goes beyond right and wrong. It isn't this. What's implied already in the story of Upalavana? Isn't that what the story is telling us? Yes, we keep precepts. And yes, when we don't, we suffer the consequences. So that's pretty clear. But even as we take the precepts, even when we break them, although we try not to break them, even if we break them, it doesn't really matter. Because the virtue of having taken them, of having committed ourselves to be Buddhas, far outweighs that. And this reminds me of something that, you know, maybe you wouldn't think of, but I've noticed this over the years. Most of the American Zen priests that I know, and I know quite a few of them, are on the whole, you know, rational people who believe in psychology and science and so on. So we tend to ordain people as lay or priest ordinees when we think they're ready, when they seem to be, you know, more or less psychologically stable and balanced, and they seem to know what they're doing, and they seem to know what's involved in taking the precepts, and so, okay, now you understand, and now you can do it, let's do it. But I've noticed that sometimes traditional Japanese priests who have been, you know, trained in traditional ways, they sometimes ordain people, even as priests, at the drop of a hat, you know, for no reason. Somebody just shows up, and the next thing, you know, they ordain him as a priest, and the person is bewildered, you know. How did that happen? I've seen this happen, you know, more than once. And I think it's because, as in the story of Upalavana, they have profound faith that there is a power and virtue in administering the precepts that will always lead in the end to good. Even if temporarily, as in the case of Upalavana, there's a detour of a lifetime or two spent in hell, that doesn't matter so much because in the end, goodness will out. So this is something to think about, right? I think most of us practice to make our life better. I mean, if someone said, you know, why don't you come and devote yourself to Zen practice, and I'll go to the sitting every month, go to the seminar, do this, do that, sessions, monasteries. It'll make your life much far worse. You'll be miserable as a result of it. But go ahead and do it, because it's really great. Most of us would say, what? I'm not doing that. No, we're doing it because somehow or other it seems to make things better, right? So that's okay. It makes sense. That's why we practice. We come. It's going to make things better, we hope. But maybe in this bigger picture of things, our life isn't actually better and we do have to suffer a lot. Maybe we even have to go to hell sometimes. But it's okay because we know we're going in the right direction and that we'll get there. And hell is just a temporary detour. Now you might think, so what is that, you know? It's kind of crazy. But actually, I have found that this has a very concrete and practical application. because I really do believe this, actually. And because I believe this, it helps me a lot to be patient with my own suffering and with the suffering of others. As you can imagine, I am aware of and in connection with a lot of people suffering. And this helps me a lot. We always try to alleviate suffering. And we should, of course, do whatever we can to alleviate suffering. But sometimes, you know, maybe we can't. Maybe it's beyond our powers to alleviate suffering. And when we can't, maybe it's good for us if we can see that that suffering is a good thing, that it's just a detour in a longer journey. Maybe we don't understand the purpose of the suffering. Maybe we don't understand its place in that journey. But we have faith that it's there. So that enables us to be stable and even optimistic and even joyful in the face of suffering. And that's certainly good for us. And also, maybe if we genuinely and really feel this way at the bottom of our heart, it's not just an ideology or something we decide to believe, but it comes from our practice, we really feel it. That maybe helps us to be of service, to help people to sustain their suffering and to see meaning in it. Now, I'm not saying we're going to go around telling people, oh, by the way, you're suffering a lot, but don't worry, you're going to be a Buddha later. You know, no, that would be a stupid thing to say to somebody. Or to say to somebody, don't worry, you're suffering a lot, but there's deep meaning in it. I don't know what it is, but there's deep meaning in it. No, that would be a ridiculous thing to say. It's not that we say stuff like that. That would be, you know, very stupid. We don't say that stuff. But if we feel it, and we really know it, maybe just that is some help. Because everybody has to suffer. I mean, this is a guaranteed price of admission into the human realm, into the realm of the living being. And this is exactly the wonder of being alive. So in this story, the ultimate position, it seems, comes at the end when Sadatsune meets the Zen master Hogai, and Hogai gives him that, you know, Zen stare, and then says, Sadatsune, and he says, yes. And he says, the precepts have now been administered. And this call and response, those of you who have been around the Zen block, how many times have you heard this before? It appears many times. It's a very commonplace trope in Zen stories. And I love it, you know, because it says it in the Bible, you know, the key moments in the Hebrew Bible, you know, God is the one who's talking instead of the Zen master, but the Zen master is like God, you know, in these stories. God says, so-and-so, you know, Laura, and Laura says, Hineni, here I am. Same thing. So it's in our tradition as well, call and response. I'm here, I am. What does it mean? I think it's saying that your specific life, just your being uniquely you, living and responding as you do every moment to the call that is your life, That's the ultimate mystery. That's the ultimate truth. And I think that's what all these stories are telling us over and over again. But here in this story specifically, it's also saying, and by the way, that's what precepts are. That's the real Jukai ceremony. It happens on every moment. We don't know it. But even so, it's happening. We are completely exercising this human life that we have been given. Without distortion. Without selfishness. Without being all knotted up by our concepts and self-denigrations. We just stand up and we say, yes, here I am, when we are called. So I'm going to finish my talk with one last quotation. I've been reading slowly a manuscript of my teacher Sojin Weitzman, of his memoir and talks, and every now and then comes a very luminous passage. So I'll quote this passage and I'll end my talk. It's not specifically about what I've been talking about, but I think, as you'll see, it's all about everything I've been talking about today. And here's words from Sojin. Very appropriate for today, especially. The life of a Zen student revolves around Zazen. And Zazen opens us up to the cosmic order. Do means the path or the way, and Kan means ring or circle. The cycle of practice, doing something over and over again. When sitting, we hold our hands in the cosmic mudra. The form of the hands creates the empty circle that holds the world in place. Everything is empty, and emptiness is everything. Although there are many things that are important in our lives, receiving our nourishment from the source has to be primary. When we survey the cosmos, we see an infinite variety of circular forms. We experience the cycles of the seasons and the cycles within the cycles within the cycles, and we realize that each one of us is the place where heaven and earth meets. We can also see that circles of energy emanate from us and mix and overlap with those of others. What kind of vibe do we want to send out into the world? The way we think and act has an effect. To sit upright in the center of the empty circle as a vehicle for light is the Zen student's life. The cycle of continuous practice of sitting Zazen, allowing that selflessness, selfless freedom to be expressed in daily life, is the turning of the wheel and the basis for harmony. Very beautiful. Very inspiring. He mentions, you know, our Zazen mudra, which we all know. We sit with our hands like this in our laps. And this also is something I've been noticing a lot lately in my own Zazen. The beauty and the depth of the mudra. It's not just your hands, you know, in a position. Paying attention to the hands and the way the thumb tips just touch each other and the way the thumb tips can be up against your belly, held lightly without stress, but with alertness, awakeness, It's a beautiful way to practice. So I'm mentioning this specifically so that maybe for the rest of today, as you sit, you can, as Keizan Zenji says, put your mind in the palms of your hand and sit with special attention to the mudra. It's a beautiful way to practice, and I've been practicing that way every day for a long time now. So I feel lucky that I have been given the assignment to think about something to say to you for today, because without that assignment I'd probably be goofing off and frittering away my time. I'd probably be listening to the Giants game or something. So thank you for providing me with this practice, and I hope that you all will have a strong rest of the sitting. Thanks for listening. And first we'll chant to end the talk, the four vows, and then if you'll be willing, we'll get up and do prostrations to end.